Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. The U.S.-Israeli war in Iran is in its third week. The Strait of Hormuz remains virtually closed. Global oil prices have risen more than 40% since the war began. Yesterday, Israel announced that it had killed two influential Iranian leaders, Ali Larijani, the head of the Supreme National Security Council, and Brigadier General Golamreza Soleimani, the head of the Bazij militia, the group aligned with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that suppresses dissent against the government. Today, Iran says that its intelligence minister, Esmail Khatib, was also killed overnight. Iran's military capacity has been severely compromised, but not enough to stop Iranian attacks in countries across the Middle East, including attacks in Tel Aviv, on the American embassy in Baghdad, and elsewhere. There is a thriving Iranian community here in Maryland. For many years, one of those Iranians was Reza Pahlavi, the son of Iran's Shah, who was deposed in the 1979 revolution. So now, almost 50 years later, is another revolution at hand? What does the future hold for Iran, and will Iranians here and abroad have a say in that future? My first guest today is Trita Parsi, a writer and foreign policy expert and the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And Trita Parsi joins me on Zoom. Trita Parsi, welcome back. It's always good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So there are, interestingly, two of several justifications for the Trump administration entering into this conflict with Iran. One is that they were an imminent threat, that they were so strong, they were an imminent threat, and we had to get rid of that threat before it was too late. The other was this was the perfect time to make a strike because they were so weakened. So those are two opposite poles of justification. I wonder, is there any truth to either argument? Were they too strong or too weak? What's your take on that assessment?
So I think I very much appreciate the way that you laid it up. Is there any truth to any of them? I don't think there was any truth in any of them, but one of them was actually believed. The other one was put out there out of necessity in order to give this war a veneer of legality. So there's been no evidence that has been provided that shows that the administration actually believed that there was an imminent threat from Iran. We saw also Joe Kent, from the head of the counterterrorism institution, yesterday resigning and saying that there was no imminent threat. Tulsi Gabbard, in her tweet yesterday, only said that the president assessed that there was an imminent threat, not that there was any evidence for it, if you read that statement very carefully. And again, no evidence has been presented. And the one justification that went the furthest in trying to explain why they thought so was what Marco Rubio said a couple of days after the war, saying that they made an assessment that the Israelis were going to attack Iran and the Iranians were likely going to attack the U.S. in return, in retaliation. And as a result, they needed to preempt that retaliation by striking first. That would still not count as an imminent threat, because it actually means that the Israelis were going to take actions that would put the U.S. at risk. And the U.S. has tremendous amount of leverage of telling the Israelis not to endanger U.S. troops rather than to let the Israelis determine when the U.S. goes to war or not. So I don't think there was any evidence or any evidence that the administration actually believed in the imminent threat theory. But they have to say it, because otherwise this war is completely illegal. The other one, however, I think they absolutely believed. They believed that the Iranians were at their weakest point ever since 1979. Marco Rubio also stated this in a Senate testimony. This was very much part of the narrative that the Israelis were advancing in order to convince Trump to green light this war, because as long as it was seen as weak and it would be easy to achieve this militarily, it would be much easier to convince Trump to go along with it, because Trump is not in principle against war. He's not in principle against regime change. He's in principle against things that are messy and do not provide him with a quick guarantee of glorious victory. But if you can convince him that the Iranians are at their weakest point ever, then you have an easier time getting him to go along with it. The Trump administration officials told regional states that they should not worry about this war. It will be over with within 100 hours. They genuinely thought that this would take 4 days. And I think that was very much premised on the idea that the Iranians are extremely weak and that gave them that opportunity to attack.
And of course, as of Saturday, we'll be into this conflict for 3 weeks. And the Israeli and U.S. goals in this war are not necessarily aligned. When it comes to regime change, for example, this is now the second time that the U.S. has bombed Iran. Once, the first time was back in June, where they went after the nuclear facility, and now, at the second time during nuclear negotiations, doing negotiations to come up with some sort of deal about their nuclear capacity. What does that mean for the next regime or the next iteration of whoever takes over the leadership in Iran?
Well, I think the Israeli objective in this war does differ quite significantly from that of the United States. Again, the Trump administration thought this would be over with within 4 days. They thought that this would either lead to the Iranians capitulating because of their weakness, or that the Iranian regime as a whole would be imploding as a result of the assassination of their supreme leader. I think the Israelis are quite content with the situation because what they are doing is going after the entire industrial base of Iran. And they're stating this openly. This is not just about their military and economic and political capabilities, the entire industrial base. This, from their standpoint, weakens Iran dramatically, sets it back decades, and as a result, shifts the balance of power in Israel's favor, and Iran's ability to pose a challenge or a threat to Israel is significantly diminished, even if the same regime remains in place. An Israeli general told me a couple of years ago when I was writing a book on Iran and Israel that Iran once was a friend of Israel's. I mean, Iran and Israel were allies back in the 1960s and 70s, but then it turned into an enemy. And he said they can once again turn into a friend, but after that, they can once again turn into an enemy. And as a result, Israel's focus cannot be on the intent of the country or the nature of its regime. Its focus has to be on its capabilities. And those capabilities are now being significantly degraded by the Israelis. That's part of the reason why they want this war to continue as long as possible. From the US side, that's a completely different story. Because again, Trump wants quick victories. He doesn't want to see the global economy suffer as the way as it does right now, because that will have trickle effects onto the U.S. economy, which will impact his own base. We're seeing gas prices already going up more than 50 cents. It's going to go up further if this war continues. This means higher grocery prices for all Americans, but those who will perhaps be more affected by it or not are actually his own voters. So I think the goals here and the timelines here are very much separate. But at this point, it appears that Trump is not in control of this war. The Israelis are taking the lead in deciding the strategy, and Trump is following.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Trita Parsi. He is a foreign policy expert and the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We're talking about Iran. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. So, Trita, we've talked about Israel's goals in this conflict, U.S. goals. What about the goals for the current Iranian regime? How do you see them? What are they hoping will happen over the next few days and weeks?
I think it's important to first recognize that the most important thing for this regime is survival. This is a very repressive theocracy in Iran. It is very unpopular. I think the vast majority of Iranians would like to get rid of this regime, would like to have a very different type of government in Iran. But this regime is still different from some of the other regimes that we've seen in the Middle East, such as that of Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, in which everything is essentially centered on an individual or his family. This regime actually is entrenched, it has a system, power is dispersed within that system, and it has a support base. A support base that I believe is no more than 15 to 20% of the population. But that is still up to 18 million people, which is dramatically different from what you had in Iraq or in Libya. And as a result, its longevity, its resilience is very, very different from what you would have in some of those other countries. So the entire proposition of getting rid of the regime militarily is much, much more difficult. And we're seeing that playing out right now. The assassination of the supreme leader did lead to sporadic celebrations throughout Iran because a lot of people obviously detest the regime as well as the supreme leader. But he also energized the supporters of this regime. And I think this is very important to understand. The war, from their standpoint, was not something that they looked for or sought. In fact, the diplomatic offers that they put on the table were very far-reaching and went well beyond what the Obama administration managed to extract from the Iranians back in 2015. But the Trump administration made a huge miscalculation because they believed that the theocracy in Iran feared war more than they feared surrender. Reality is the opposite. They feared surrender far more than they feared war because they believe that they can survive a war. They can even come out stronger from that war, even if they lose it. But they cannot survive a surrender because if they surrender, they lose that 18 million support base that they have left. And as a result, they were moving towards war, even though the Trump administration kept on thinking that they would be capitulating.
I mean, so far, U.S. Have struck more than 5,000 targets. 1,300 Iranian civilians have been killed, according to Iranian sources. You wrote in the New York Times about the administration making an argument that U.S. and Israel would only attack, police stations that were controlled by the Bazij forces, the IRGC surrogates who go out and suppress dissent, and that they can degrade the capacity for the Iranian regime to repress dissent. That would pave the way for the people to rise up. What do you think of that theory? And has that theory at all played out in these first 2.5 weeks of the war?
I don't think that we see that. We do see that the United States has tried to degrade, and the Israelis absolutely have had some success in degrading the state's repressive capacities. But we have not seen people rising up in the manner that that theory had laid out. For instance, there are two specific moments in which we should have seen something if this theory, at least in this short time period, could have worked. That was first after the supreme leader was assassinated. That was 24 hours in which the Iranian system was in some, perhaps not disarray, but it was in a state of shock. That was a moment in which you could have seen something happening. You saw some people celebrating, but you did not see any mass protests. You did not see any mass mobilization or any actual threat against the system. The second one was actually last night. Last night is Chorshanbe Suri in Iran. That is the last Tuesday evening before the Iranian New Year. It's an ancient Persian-Iranian tradition. It's pre-Islamic. Over the course of the last couple of years, it's increasingly become a night in which there are protests against the regime because it's a celebration of Iran's pre-Islamic past vis-a-vis the Islamic nature of this current theocracy. The son of the former Shah had called on people to go out and use this evening as a way of protesting and bringing down the regime. I spoke to several people in Tehran last night. There were normal celebrations of Chorshanbe Suri, but nothing of any scale challenging the regime at all, despite the fact that a lot of IRGC and Basij members have been killed over the course of the last 3 months. Now, you can say that if this continues for a much longer period of time, perhaps they will be sufficiently degraded that people could rise up. That is theoretically possible. But the question is, how long time would that take? And how much time would that give the Iranian theocracy and government the ability to further undermine the global economy, choke hold the Strait of Hormuz, push up gas prices, and create all of these different challenges elsewhere? And the way I see it, I don't see the likelihood of that happening inside of Iran, particularly mindful of the fact that you simultaneously see this mobilization of the base of the regime within a time frame that is possible for Trump and the global economy to tolerate. So whereas there may be a theoretical basis for that approach, we're not seeing it happening. And in addition to that, you're also seeing that the Israelis are bombing power plants, oil refineries, desalination plants, which the US also has bombed. Those are not degrading the repressive capabilities of the states. Those are degrading the country as a whole. And that actually brings us closer to a state collapse at some point, potentially, which would be devastating for the region because of the instability that would create, but also would be devastating for the Iranian people because you're not going to see a democracy emerge out of a failed state.
And so just to be clear, you're saying that the repressive capability of this regime remains pretty much intact, and it's certainly something that people fear. They are not going out to the streets in large numbers because of the fear of that. Or is it just the fear of that? Is it the fear of being bombed by American or Israeli planes? I mean, what is the
The
what,
second point that you raise is also very important because you can see it, and I've spoken to a lot of people in Iran, and I think it's also been quite extensively reported. There were some in Iran that welcomed this. They are under so much pressure from this theocracy. They're so tired of having to live under this. So they, out of desperation, thought that perhaps the United States could come and get rid of the theocracy, and this would end up being something positive. Now, when they're seeing that the country is being bombed, the fact that during the first day of this war, a girls' school was bombed twice by the United States, killing more than 160 school children, I think a lot of them are rethinking this. Doesn't mean that they're in any way, shape, or form supporting the theocracy, but they're realizing that this idea that there is such a thing called democracy bombs is just not a reality because they're getting killed themselves. The country is getting destroyed, and the prospects of democracy coming out of this is not at all what they may have thought from the beginning. I personally don't think that this was in any way, shape, or form the majority of the Iranian people, but it was a sizable and vocal minority. I don't think it is that sizable any longer, mindful of how this war has actually ended up.
you mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. About 20% of the world's oil production goes through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has closed it off for all intents and purposes. How long can they sustain that? How long can Iran just prohibit shipping through the Strait of Hormuz?
This has proven to be one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest unforeseen events in this war from the standpoint of the United States. The reason why it was unforeseen is frankly shocking to me, because the US has war gamed this many, many times, and they know very well that the Iranians have the ability to close the straits. What has changed here, however, is that if this had been done 20 years ago, the manner in which the Iranians would have closed the straits would be by mining the straits. By mining the straits, it would also be suicidal for them because they would not be able to get their own oil tankers out of the Persian Gulf. And it would mean that they would stop selling oil themselves. What they're doing now is essentially a smart closure of it. They're controlling of who goes in and who goes out because they're not mining the straits. They just have the capacity of shooting rockets at ships in a manner that the US cannot stop. And as a result, the risk of going through the straits is too high if you're not on the list of countries that the Iranians currently are permitting. That is China, Russia, India, and Pakistan as things stand right now. So the Iranians have that ability, which also has led to them actually exporting more oil now after the war started than they were doing prior to the war. The US has very limited options of reopening the straits, particularly options that are not very costly. This would potentially mean actually bringing real naval forces into the Persian Gulf. I think it's very important to understand most, if not the vast majority, of the US's naval forces are not in the Persian Gulf. They're in the Indian Ocean, roughly 3,000 kilometers away from where Iran is.
And there are reports of 2,500 Marines that are currently in Singapore on their way
On their way,
to
yes.
the conflict, but it's going to take them a while to get there. Yeah.
It's going to take them a while, but it's important to understand that these naval assets of the United States are not closer to Iran's shores, not because there hasn't been time for them to go there, but because the Iranians have missiles that potentially even could sink an American aircraft carrier. So, in order to reduce casualties and significant damage to the US has by and large emptied its bases in the region, and it has kept its naval forces far away. Now, could it go in with naval forces and reopen the strait? By sheer force, yes, but at a huge casualty rate. And again, that is exactly what Trump thought that he never would have to deal with, because he thought the Iranian system would implode or surrender within 100 hours.
About a week ago, on the 11th of March, Mojtaba Khamenei was appointed the new supreme leader, succeeding his father, who was killed on the first night of the conflict by Israeli warplanes. What do you make of that choice? What do you think we can anticipate moving forward with this regime?
So I think, first of all, the choice of Mojtaba Khamenei, which is the son of the former supreme leader, was a way for this Iranian government to signal utmost defiance against the United States. As you may recall, Trump even stated prior to this decision being made that he would not accept Mojtaba Khamenei as the supreme leader, essentially saying that he would be unacceptable to the United States. I think that actually dramatically increased the likelihood that Mojtaba Khamenei would be selected, precisely because they wanted to signal defiance. But I think it's also important to recognize that had this decision not been made in wartime, there's a very significant likelihood that Mojtaba Khamenei would not have been selected. If this was a decision made in peacetime, it would probably have been someone else because of the symbolics of actually choosing the son of a previous supreme leader, which kind of gives this theocracy a monarchical dimension and quality, which is quite paradoxical, mindful of the fact that this revolution was against the monarchy. But because of these specific circumstances, he was chosen. He is someone we know very little about. There's hardly any interviews with him, very few footages of him, but we do know a couple of things. His father, his mother, his wife, and his child, as well as sister and brother-in-law, were all killed in that bombing. He himself was injured. We do not know how severe his injuries are. There's no images of him after that attack. He has issued one statement, which was read on Iranian TV by the anchor, not in his own voice. Some speculate that he may not even be alive. We do not know at this point. But the general view tends to be that he is more hardline than his father was, and that in some ways, this is pushing the Islamic Republic in an even more hawkish direction than he was before. We don't know yet, I want to emphasize. And we don't even know if he's alive or if he will survive. But the trend so far seems to, in general, have been in a more hawkish direction.
Yeah, there are some reports that he was secretly sent to Russia to receive medical treatment for his injuries. But again, it's almost impossible to confirm that one way or the other. So, Trita Parsi, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. Very, very enlightening. And I learned a lot, and as did all of our listeners. So I'm grateful. Thanks so much. We'll be in touch.
So much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Trita Parsi is a foreign policy expert and co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, the Iranian diaspora anxiously watches the war from afar. A local resident and her father will share their thoughts as the violence continues for a third week. It's Midday on Foreign Policy. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR.